Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show by dialing 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Kim Colton is manning the switchboard tonight. Hiya, Kim.
Hi, Denny. I'm doing very well tonight, and how are you?
Well, not too bad. I can't complain. Well, I could, but I'm not going to. I'll put it that way.
Nobody'd listen.
But they should tell me nobody gives a damn.
Tonight,
we're pleased to have Karen D. Socia as our guest. Karen is an author, writes a weekly column for the Charlotte Observer, has had articles published in various magazines, and is a contributor to Yahoo.com. She's a corporate speechwriter and editor. A member of Screen Actors Guild, Karen has acted in film, television, and industrial promotional videos. She has also voiced radio commercials. Her new book, Kidnapped by the Cartel. The book tells a fact-based story of a young American woman abducted by a Mexican drug cartel, held captive in Tijuana, Mexico, and her family's efforts to get her back. Karen, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you so much, Denny, and hello, Kim.
Hello, Karen. Thank you so much for being with us.
I appreciate you inviting me.
Karen, I'd like to start off, if you could. Now, this story, is, as I indicated in the opening, is fact-based. Could you give us the background a little bit about the story and the backstory, if you will, and how this gelled up for you?
Sure. A few years ago, a family member was abducted from her car in broad daylight in Tijuana, Mexico. Now, at the time she went missing, we did not know where she was. But after a few days, we ascertained that she was in Mexico, because when you call a cell phone, your American phone, and if it's across the border, it makes a funny ring first. So she was missing. The family was involved. We were petrified, didn't know where she was, what was happening to her. At one point, a Mexican-sounding voice had answered the phone when we kept trying to call her and said that she was with them. And then the phone went dead, and that was the end of that. Her car was found stripped. It was a panic for the family, to know what is going on and what to do and how to find her and get her back. That was the whole goal.
And how old was this young lady?
She was in her early 20s. Now, she was one of those, very petite. She looked like she was maybe 16 or 18, actually, but she was in her early 20s. And it was a very harrowing experience for everyone. It was just horrendous, horrendous.
Wow, So you became aware at some point as a family member, mm-hmm, that this had occurred. About how long after the abduction did you become aware of it yourself?
She was gone probably 3 days when I first got the call that she was missing, and then I was involved in the search after. I don't live in California, but I flew out there and was physically involved in the search for several days. She was missing 11 days. And
11 days total.
11 days total, and you can practically lose your mind with the thoughts that you're having in 11 days. So I feel my heart went out after this experience to anybody who's ever had a family member abducted for any reason. It just changes your perspective once you're involved in something like that. And then I learned so much about Mexican drug cartels and border situations and Department of Homeland Security. And I used to think prior to this episode that Americans were kidnapped by the cartel primarily for ransom, because that's what you heard the most about. But that wasn't the case, or that's not the case still. They kidnap for a lot of reasons. And young Americans are very vulnerable when they cross the border into Tijuana or Juarez or one of the border towns that are kind of nasty.
When you did your research, when you found out that the abduction had taken place and you became involved in the recovery efforts, the search and recovery efforts, and you obviously learned a lot at that time, and then I'm assuming, and we'll get to that in a minute, did additional research for the book, but did you find, you mentioned that you thought up until that time you had thought that ransom would have been the key motivator for abductions such as happened to this family member. Did anything else surprise you, either initially during the actual effort to get the girl back or in your subsequent research for the book? Were there any surprises, things that you had a misconception about prior?
There were many surprises. We didn't know who had her during this whole time. Right up even until through the 11 days, we did not know for sure who had her. We knew she was being held by somebody. Her car was found stripped. And I learned that the Mexican police, at least at this time, I can't speak to today, but at this time, they didn't all talk to each other. Like here in the United States, the FBI and the Sheriff's Department will work in conjunction. There, we would go to a police department, police office on a corner with like a poster with her picture and say, can you help us? And then they would say, well, you need to go to talk to this other police department. We go, well, can't you, you know, call them or do it? Nobody really helped us. There was no help in Mexico. We tried to get to the American consulate. It was closed. We just had horrible situations. And the timing, there was no sense of urgency. We would go have to sit and wait in long lines to try to get help in a police department, but then to find out there was no help. The San Diego police were right up front with saying that they couldn't help because she was across the border. So we were really surprised at the lack of help then at that time in Mexico. And then, of course, there was always the fear of which police who could you trust? Because you read about, you know, somebody, they don't make that much money, so the cartel pays them, so somebody's on the take, and how do you know what to do? There was a constant state of fear and agitation. We stuck together as a group because we didn't want to lose anybody else, and we had people with us, and we would go across the border, come back, and go back every day. It was, and spend a lot of cash trying to get information. We saw so much of the seedy side that it was overwhelming.
Now, when on these trips, the family, you and other family members made across the border, you say you would go back and forth. In other words, you didn't actually rent places in Tijuana, right?
No. In fact, we would only stay for a few hours at a time. Although the males that were involved in the search towards the end took way more chances. They felt they had to. It was a life and death situation. Towards the end, we knew it, we felt it, we heard it from underground, and so they did what they had to do. But after this event, I was just so mortified by everything, and we were all so traumatized, and that down the road a bit, I felt like, family members encouraged me, because I am a writer, to write about this. So then doing research, and I did go back into Tijuana to do research in daylight, although she was kidnapped in broad daylight too, but I went back with people and talked to the Mexican police and San Diego police and detox centers and rehab facilities and things, and found out that this was not an isolated incident, that these types of things were happening. And so then I talked to reporters, and I did so much research. I spoke to a man that wrote a book called The Mexican Mafia, who's now in hiding, actually, because his book, his true story, talked about how the cartel had crossed into the United States for doing kidnappings, and he named names and appeared in a court. So he's now living under an assumed name, but I was able to speak with him through different avenues. So the stories that I was hearing was just, oh my gosh, even more harrowing than what we went through, way more harrowing in some aspects. So I created a character in my book, Kidnapped by the Cartel. I created the character Amanda, and what happens to her in this book is a compilation of all these different things I heard and the research I did.
So it's based on some of the stuff you learned firsthand during the search and rescue, if you will, operation that you were involved in with the family, and then additional research and other information that developed after your family member was returned. That's correct?
Yes, exactly. And I did that because there was so much more information that the initial thought paled in comparison to what I needed to say. Do you know what I'm saying? I wanted people to see that, okay, when I was first writing the book and the publisher would say, who's your target audience? Who's your target audience? Well, I find now that it's kind of fallen into sort of two groups. One is people that have a family member maybe that's involved in drugs or knows somebody or something like this, and has maybe young adults that want to go into Mexico or hang out, because you can go to the pharmacies there and get anything without a prescription, especially if you know which ones are the best ones to go to, and that word travels fast among people. So the book appeals to them because it's a cautionary tale. Then on the other side, it's kind of like the movie Taken. I've been told that by people that have read the book, that it reminds them of the movie Taken. So it's exciting and scary and has all those elements. So for people that are like crime, that like to read crime novels or watch the crime TV shows and things like that, this book appeals to them because it's like fast paced and it's like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. I've had so many emails from people say, I read the book in 2 days. I couldn't put it down. I missed meetings and stuff like this, which as a writer, I'm excited to hear that. But so it appeals to both, you know, two different elements, I guess.
I'm just curious. You mentioned that some of the issues and difficulties, when I say you, I mean the search people involved in the search, encountered such as a lack of cooperation and stuff. Generally speaking, were you disappointed in, it sounds like maybe in the Mexican law enforcement operation, at least as it was at that particular time. And I'm gathering that maybe there wasn't a whole lot of communication or help that could be provided by American police agencies. I don't know about the FBI, but at least the San Diego police, in that apparently the lines of communication at that time with their Mexican counterparts weren't that effective.
Oh, not at all. And I want to say that this was a few years ago, so I don't know how it is now. But at that time, the San Diego police were firm, we can't do anything about it. So at first, we were just like, we couldn't believe it. We're like, you know, she's an American, what's going on? And they said, well, if it becomes evident that there's a crime and, you know, there had to be like, it's almost like they won't put, you know, you don't get a stoplight at a corner until there's been an accident, even though there's been close accidents. That's how the feeling we had here was, are we supposed to wait until she's in the morgue? I mean, it was horrendous. So they did finally, when we had posters, we had some made in English as well as in Spanish. And so they did take some of those, the San Diego police. And when her car was listed as stolen, that was helpful because then they could be kind of on the lookout for that car. This was before we found out it was stripped and in Tijuana. We didn't even know how she got there, first of all. So we just listed her car as stolen to just alert people to look for the car and the border. And there's a TV channel out there that did a piece on her, too, and it was a bilingual channel, Telemundo. And so that was helpful. But I guess when it's your family member, you want help, and we just were, and this took a period over 11 days, remember, so the first few days there was like nothing, nobody knew. We were persistent, like water on a rock. I even started writing to America's Most Wanted to try to see could they suggest a resource, but I didn't finish the letter because at the time I was writing it, then we went back, you know, we stopped that morning and went to Tijuana, and then just things started snowballing. We started getting tips in Tijuana from people?
The State Department, you mentioned that one time it would somebody from the family tried to get their assistance. Did you ever make contact or somebody from the family with the State Department, and what were they able to do if you did?
You mean in Tijuana?
Well, anywhere where the United States government would have played a role.
No.
No.
The only help that we got at that time was they took the posters in San Diego, and I'm not even sure how many. We went to this one police station that was near where everything was, and that's the one we talked to the most, and I think they took a few posters. I'm not sure what they did with them. That was really kind of about it. I mean, as I can recall, when the car was found, we found out the car was found from the insurance company, even. So, I mean, it was just the most amazing set of circumstances, and just scary. I mean, so now the car is found stripped. So there's no car, there's no phone. Who's got her? She can't communicate. She can't get, you know, nothing. And you're in the dark of night when you go to bed, I'll tell you what, your mind can really take you to places you don't want to go.
Yeah, did the during this 11-day period, did there come a point where the authorities finally said, okay, this is an abduction, it's not just a runaway or somebody off on a fling, you know, type thing? Or was it kind of up to the family to act
with the belief that
it was an abduction and not try to convince the authorities? The authorities apparently didn't want to know nothing, like you said, until maybe somebody ended up in the morgue.
They said they had no jurisdiction. She's in Mexico. They have no jurisdiction. Sorry. I mean, that was...
And you said there were issues with the Mexican police, too. Did they seem to take this seriously, or did they kind of poo-poo it?
Well, I don't know if they... It was almost like they didn't care. It depended which coroner office you went to. Most of them really didn't care and didn't seem to like Americans. They just were not helpful. We had with us a bilingual private investigator who was actually Mexican-American, who had been a state trooper, I think, or something in California. He was retired, and he helped people like this. This was not his first case doing this, that it was hired. And so he would speak. And he would just say, warn us before we'd go to each place. He'd say, you have to be calm, you have to be patient. First of all, it was like a million degrees, no air conditioning. I mean, just to paint the picture of you're sweating because of what's going on, and you're sweating because it's hot, and you're sweating because you're waiting for 2 hours to get up there for them to say, next, you know, can't help you, next. You're wait a minute, that's all I got was 2 seconds, and it's next. And when we wanted to find the car, we thought maybe there would be some sort of a clue. We got sent to the wrong place, and then another place, and then drove out of town up this hill, and there's killer dogs guarding this trash heap.
Right.
I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was like living a movie. But at the time, you're scared to death all the time and trying to keep yourself strong.
The family believed it was an abduction fairly early on. Did there ever come a point where it was more than a belief? I mean, where the family says, okay, we now have some type of contact or evidence where it definitely was an abduction, where there was no doubt what had happened?
Well, when the man answered her phone and said, oh, well, I don't really want to say on the radio what he said, but he said she was my wife, and then he's like swears and laughs and hangs up. So you're like, what? And, you know, petrified. And then you can't get through with the phone again, ever. And then the car was found a couple days later, stripped. So you know that there's no phone, no car, no means for her to communicate at all or to get out or what. So the assumption we made was she's there against her will. Otherwise, why would
it? Let's just back up a tad here. The girl, and again, we don't want to identify her by name or anything, but the not Amanda, not the fictional character, but the real person. Was she lived in the San Diego area or somewhere, or was she just out visiting?
She lived in San Diego. She lived in San Diego, and was comfortable, actually, with Tijuana when you grew up there. I mean, people go there, Rosarita, for lobsters all the time and things like that. And a lot of kids went to her high school that were from Mexico, that the parents would get a second place, wealthy Mexicans would get a second place so that the kids could get an education in America. So you become very easy with the idea of Tijuana when you grew up there and cross the border. And there's a lot of crossing back and forth, like I said. So I think it was a very comfortable feeling initially.
It's,
this was an eye-opener for everybody.
It's, you know, people who, like you say, maybe aren't used to being in Tijuana or never been there. They might tend to be more on guard, I would think, than the person who you say is relatively comfortable.
Right.
You know, through experience and through having done it or been there probably on numerous occasions, may have been a little more susceptible. But I was curious, you said that not only in this case, the real case, but in your research afterward that led to the book and helped you with the book, that ransom is not necessarily the major motivation for abductions. What types of other reasons are there? Why would these cartel people want to abduct someone?
Well, they wanted at this time, and maybe still now, they wanted young Americans because they would use them to transport drugs across the border for them, under threat of death to them and their family, because they had their ID, so they could find out easily where they lived, where they were, you know, who their family was. And this was the threat that was made, threat of death. They starve them. They feed them, keep them drugged up. They are, I mean, if you're held by somebody and you don't want to be for 11 days and you're starved and you're doing, you know, it's a threat of death, you're trying to think of how can you get away and how can you get away with your life, but how can you protect your family? So it's mind games as well as just a horrible situation all the way around. So they would use them to, one of the things was to transport drugs across the border, drive a loaded vehicle. And I wanted to call at the time President Bush and say, I know what's going on. I know something that's going on here. But I was like scared, to be honest, to do that. And if they could put, they had it all wired that they could get through the border patrol and the drug sniffing dogs and everything else. They could have guns. They could have anything in there. But I know that they were doing that with drugs. And at that time, it was just prior to when they decided you had to have your passport to cross into come back to Mexico. At that time, you just needed a driver's license. So one of the first things they did was make several copies of her driver's license. They go, we all know where you live, where your family lives. And first of all, they don't know where you are, and you'll never see them again if you don't do what we say, and they'll never see the light of day if you don't do what we say. So there's a lot of threats and intimidation.
Yeah, like you say, the victim, the person being held, has to think not only of their own survival, but also that of their family, because I'm sure if they didn't realize that the abductors probably make it perfectly clear to them that
constantly,
their family could be,
yes,
family members could,
right,
be at risk if they don't follow whatever orders they are given.
Right, and it's repeated over and over until you're just so petrified that you're driven to do what you have to do to survive and for them to survive.
Now, a question, and again, this is not necessarily about your family member, but generally speaking from your research and so on, if I believe sometimes they call these couriers mules, I've heard that
type of
a reference before,
yes,
the people that carry the drugs, but in addition to keeping them alive, and it was not killing them, do they get any other reward? Like, do they pay them, or they just basically let them live and keep them?
They don't
in
always
drugs
let them. They don't always let them live. That's the thing.
Okay,
is that that's not their goal. Their goal is to use them until they can't use them. If they're like the females, they are often transported to Mexico City for to be used in their prostitution trade. Sometimes they're sent on to Russia. They can be never found again. I mean, certainly that's a trail you can't follow. You'll hear about, you can read about it. It's often, like in Time Magazine or anything, you'll read about, I remember not that long ago, three American college boys were like, their bodies were found. Now, what happened between the time they went to Tijuana and the 3 weeks before their body was found? Were they used to transport drugs? Were they, did somebody kill them just so that they could prove that they're brave enough to be in the cartel? I mean, there's so many different reasons that they would take these young Americans and use them and abuse them, and they don't want to necessarily just return them. I mean, it's not to their advantage to do that. They may, for ransom, they may, but if you're not kidnapped for ransom, that's maybe worse.
Hello?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Okay, I thought I lost you.
No.
So, you know, I've written some books myself about the American mafia,
mm-hmm.
so-called
yes,
mafia.
Yes, I know. You're a tremendous writer. I feel honored to be talking to you.
Well, thank you. And I what I've come away with from my research and so forth with the American mobsters is especially the so-called organized crime, such as the you know, the five families in New York and so forth, the Italian American mob, is that these guys may do some bad things, but they have a certain, I think, code of ethics.
Right.
People might scoff at that, but I believe they do, and I think the gangs, if you will, I'm not going to call them necessarily organized crime, but the gangs out there today, including these Mexican cartels and some of the gangs here in the States, don't really seem to have any ethics. I mean, nothing is beyond them.
I have to agree with that. They'll kill their own mother. It's horrible. It's horrible. The things that I have read, and even subsequent to me finishing writing the book, the stuff that continues to go on. I mean, just, 2 weeks ago in Acapulco, it's the killings, and they just, their own, I don't know, they're twisted. There is no respect for life or for anything. It's appalling, and I just don't even know how a person can become so brutal. It's sad.
It really is, and you know, there's so much money involved, money and power and all this kind of thing. I don't know how you reverse that. I mean,
right.
this set that these people have, and apparently no moral compass at all. I mean, zero. And how do you reverse that? I don't know.
And the thing is that since there's so much poverty in Mexico and there's so much money in the cartel, that they recruit young. Children really and raise them in their way, and they threaten the families, the parents, they kill them, they don't care, they'll kill them in front of each other. I mean the things that I have read, it just makes you scared to death to want to go there. And so tourism is down, and oh really? And there was a thing just recently that, you know, tourism was down. Well, Acapulco, well, that's out. I mean, I guess the few places that people still go to, like Cancun and Cabo, there, I don't know. I suppose it's okay to go there. I personally just don't know how badly I would want to go back into Mexico. Certainly not into Tijuana anymore. I did go back a few times doing research for the book, but I don't even want to. It's got too bad memories, and I would hate to see something happen or be involved in something that would happen for whatever reason. And I'm not an alarmist. I'm not trying to alarm people. Everybody makes their own decisions. But things go on, and it's just awful.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think back. I don't know just how many years ago it was, but it wasn't all that long ago. We had signed up for a cruise to the Mexican Riviera.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember then that it may have been Acapulco. There was one or two of the ports that the ship was scheduled to visit that got one of them got canceled altogether, and it turned into an extra sea day. And the other one, they put in an alternate port because they said the danger was so extreme that they couldn't or wouldn't allow passengers off the ship in those locations.
It's terrible. You know, and so that makes it more difficult for people there who want to do the right thing or who are making a living by the cruise ship stopping, you know, restaurant owners or something like that. There's no place for them to turn when, I mean, Acapulco, they just said that the other day, the last cruise ship that was going there no longer will. So now none of them are going. And Acapulco used to be a big tourist place, a fun place. I had never been there, but I've heard a lot about it. And sadly, that's not the case anymore.
That's it's scary. And like you say, getting back to the search and so forth, is with what you hear and know about the situation in Mexico and the underpaid, allegedly at least underpaid police,
right,
who may be on the take or, you know, maybe actually working for the cartels, who do you go to? Because you go to the wrong person, the wrong cop, the wrong police station.
Right.
And tell them how much you know, if anything, and you might not get out of there.
Exactly. That's just it. So there was that while we were there. We didn't know who to trust. We didn't know what to do. But time kept going, you know, another day and another day. And I had remembered reading at one point in time when someone goes missing that after 3 days, your odds of finding them unharmed or something like that get lessened, and then after X amount of days, and then it becomes maybe you're looking for a body. We never wanted to think like that. We didn't want to. But, I mean, in the dark of night we did, and sometimes we would just cry, and we prayed, and we did everything. And we would look mistrustingly at people in Mexico, and I felt like they were looking mistrustingly at us, and it was just very harrowing.
Other than family members, I know you said you had a bilingual private investigator involved. Were there other non-family people involved, you know, in the actual search and the going into Tijuana pieces?
Yes. Some friends came, which that was very brave of them to do, males, actually. And so you owe a lot to somebody who would risk their life for, you know, your family member. It kept getting worse as it went along, to be honest. It started off bad, and then it just started getting worse because you start thinking of things and your mind goes, and then you read something in the paper that night and you're like, holy smokes. And when you can't get a hold of somebody and nobody knows anything and no friends or nobody knows anything, you're just grasping for straws, and it's awful. It's very scary. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And I know after doing this research that it happens to a lot of people. And that's, you know, so sad.
You know, it's I'm just thinking here, and I'm in fact reading your book now. I'm about halfway through it and enjoying it. It's you said eye-opener earlier in the show, and it certainly is, and I really admire the amount of research. And so, of course, some of it was kind of forced on you during the real deal. But let me ask you now. We've got two different things. So you had the actual incident that you went through,
right,
personally, you know, with the abduction, and then you did your follow-up research and so forth to write this book. I assume, and I want to make sure I'm right here, that you fictionalized it and created the Amanda character for a couple of reasons. One probably would be to protect this girl. I mean, the girl,
right,
who had been abducted got out,
yeah, mm-hmm,
and you probably didn't want to do anything that would maybe antagonize that situation. The other thing is you said that you could kind of encompass in your fictional character, your Amanda character, a lot of the other stuff you learned.
Right.
And inserted into that whole scenario. Am I correct there?
Yes. You're absolutely correct on both counts. I wanted to protect my family member as much as possible, the privacy, just everything. And all that people, the general public, would need to know about her in specific was that she was kidnapped, forced to, you know, starved and forced to run drugs across the border, and there was a rescue. Other than that, I think that's enough about her. Do you know what I'm saying? Her personal experience. But
right.
Putting into what I learned about so many, and I felt I owed it to some of these people that didn't make it back, to some of the young Americans that didn't make it back, to tell part of their story too. And so that's what, like this book, while it's inspired by a true story, it's fiction inspired by a true story, it's true to a lot of people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Elements are true to this person and true to that person and true to that person. And I felt like it was just sort of honoring them in a way that their story was a little bit in there as well. So in the Amanda character is a lot of people's stories.
Now, are you, of course, the book is new. When did the book actually, when was the release?
I think 2 weeks ago, maybe. About.
No. I anticipate that probably over a period of time, you might get contacted by people who actually had been through something similar. Do you think you will?
I might. In fact, I got an email today from somebody who said that their close friend's family went through something similar to this, and did I want to talk about it? Now, I haven't responded to that yet because that was something I never even thought about, how I would handle that. It didn't even occur to me, I guess. But if I could give comfort to somebody, I certainly would. I don't know of names. I don't have names for people. Like, you know, do you know what happened to Joe Smith? I don't specifically can't answer that, and I certainly, you know, wouldn't. But when I heard these different stories from that, like, say, from a police officer in San Diego might say, well, there was this kid a month ago that this happened. Do you know what I'm saying? And it wasn't important to me to know necessarily this person's name, but it was males or females. They were kidnapping both, boys, you know, young men and young women.
Yeah. Now, how tough was this book to write for you? Was it a difficult write? Did you have any issues with it, or did it go pretty well? Karen?
Denny, we seem to have lost Karen.
Karen, I thought something happened here. I don't know. I was lost too for a second there.
Yeah. She is off the switchboard. Let's just give it, we got 21 minutes left of the show. Let's just see if she calls back in. I think it's just so interesting that the family, in the beginning when she was talking about the family traveling from the U.S. and then across the border and then back across and then cross again and staying in their group, which, of course, is very important. It's just not like the old days. I remember going to Tijuana with my parents when I was just a kid. I'm not going to tell you how old I was, but Dad always said, you know, hang close. Do you never walk away. And here's Karen. Here we go.
Well, I'm not sure what happened, but I was talking to myself all of a sudden. I realized I was talking to myself.
Oh, you're back. Thank you.
And I got cut off myself, so we got kind of discombobulated. Karen, why don't you go ahead and whatever you were talking about when you were talking to yourself, go ahead and tell us.
Where were we? Well, I think that what was surprising was the fact that they were kidnapping young Americans there, and that, like, college kids or something like that, because you would think kids would like to go there to party. The police would say that, well, you know, they just like to go for a bender and for a fun weekend or to go have lobsters and Rosarita or something. And So that's why the San Diego police in the beginning weren't that concerned, because they go, well, has she been there before? Did she stay, you know, has she ever gone anywhere where you didn't know where she was and all this kind of stuff? And go, that has nothing to do with this. We know that something's going on here, something very strange. So that part was hard. And then when I started finding out what was going on when I was doing the research, I would take breaks, because it was just like overwhelming. It was overwhelming. And then I had my normal life. I mean, I'm writing for a newspaper. I have all these other things. And so I could put it on the back burner for a while and just live. And then it was there haunting me. And I would have family members say, "Aren't you? How are you doing on the book? What's going on with the book?" So then I would go back to it. So it was a process. It was a big project, writing a book of this nature. And I wanted to do the research and present a good book. So it took a while.
So how long did it take you from when you first come up with the idea, or the thought that you were going to do a book, and then through the research and the writing? So how long did it take for the entire project from the idea through the release a couple of weeks ago?
Okay. Well, it took a few years, because first of all, after the event, I wanted to see how things were going to evolve for the family member. I wasn't going to write a book if there was going to be a terrible ending. And so I waited a couple of years, basically, to even start, although I had notes. I had all my notes and everything. And so then I started going back and doing some research and taking pictures in Tijuana, things like that. And so it took probably 5.5 years to do this.
Wow.
With the breaks that I took of months where I didn't do anything. And then I would go back to it. And during that time, I would kind of have a different focus. I would learn something new, and I'd be like, oh, wow, I've got to incorporate this, because this is really important. So it was a big process like that. And I had never written a book. I'd written a lot of other things, articles and stories, but I'd never written a book. And I wanted it to be well-written. I wanted it to be interesting. I wanted the two different factions of people to be satisfied with it, I guess. And actually, a woman from San Francisco bought my book online, I guess like at Amazon.com or something, and sent me a message and said, "I just want you to know that I've got two college kids who are not going to be going for spring break to Mexico. And I appreciate you say," and I don't even know her. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I felt good about that, not only because she wanted to keep them safe. There's other places. Like I said, I'm not an alarmist, but all you have to do is read the paper every day, or look on the internet, and you see heads will roll in Mexico, and that's literal. So, I mean, I wouldn't want my young adult to go there again.
No, absolutely not. And I was mentioning a few minutes ago about that cruise that where they switched the ports because of the danger. Even before the cruise line did that, I told my wife, I said, "Look, I said, you know, there are certain places there that we're scheduled to stop at." I says, "And I just want to tell you, I'm either going to stay on the ship or just hang around right at the port.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to be getting in one of these taxis or something with somebody that doesn't speak and getting whisked off to somewhere where they tell you they're taking you to a shopping mall, you know, and who knows where you're going to end up." So, it's got to be costing the merchants there, you know, how many hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars.
So then what is their option now? You know, so the cartel comes and says, "You're going to do this." They're already starving. I mean, I feel sad for the people there. I feel very sad for the people there. I know that the Americans have tried to help the situation, our government. I don't know that much about that part. We want to protect our citizens, and I know the cartel has crossed the border, and because that's what that one guy had written about, was the fingers reaching into the United States doing kidnappings here for them, for the cartel in Mexico. So the Department of Homeland Security certainly wants to protect Americans in America first. And then they put out the caution, it's not safe to travel. Don't cross the border. Don't go into the border towns.
I was just wondering, you mentioned when we were talking about the length of your book project, and
yeah.
that you waited for a reasonable amount of time. She wanted to, you know, make sure that the
mm-hmm.
family member was going to be okay. I assume that there were, as far as you know, there were no long-lasting effects of what she went through. Was she able to, you know, was she resilient enough to be able to get past that?
Yeah. I hesitate to focus on her too much, but I will say I have the utmost respect for her. Strong individual, smart, and wonderful, and living a great life now. So.
Well, that's good because I could see where a lot of people. Looking at it, if they were the victim, okay, it's tough enough
mm-hmm.
for the family, but
right.
when you take them and what they go through, that probably don't bounce back. I mean, that, you know.
Oh,
even
no,
they...
there's many that, oh, yeah, there's many that don't. I just saw, maybe it was like Time Magazine or maybe USA Today or something, where this woman who is now married with two children was abducted as a child in the United States by some, you know, pervert and kept like in a how they dig holes and put them in that type of a situation like that
uh-huh.
little boy was just in Arizona or New Mexico or wherever. Okay, and she was there for like 15 days or something, and when she was rescued she was taken in by a foster family because she prior to that had been abused by her own family. Very sad story. But now she's married and with children, has two children. And she only came out now because she wanted people to know that you can. She wanted other people that have been through something to know you can survive. You can, but not certainly everybody does. Excuse me.
Yeah, you got it. Well, you mentioned a few seconds ago here that you know a tough individual. You got to be mentally tough. I thank God I've never been through that kind of thing. But you got to be mentally tough. I would.
And get good counseling. Good counseling,
yeah.
supportive people behind you. I think all those things matter big time. You know, just I think that's probably tantamount to a recovery situation. It took a couple of years though.
Yeah, well, yeah, these things don't happen overnight.
No.
That's for sure. Before we move on, why don't you tell us, too, you mentioned your book's available on Amazon. Tell
mm-hmm.
us any other place it's available or your website or any information
mm-hmm.
like that.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, it's available on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, iBookstore, I think. I'm going to have an audio version come out soon. I have a website, www.KarenDeShosha.com, and the spelling is kind of hard, but I think if you looked up the book Kidnapped by the Cartel, then you'll find it. If that would be a better way than trying to find my name.
Okay.
Excuse me.
You know, when we had our phone glitch a few minutes ago, I got
mm-hmm.
back on a few seconds before you did, and I was Kim and I were talking, and I was just about to tell her that one of the things that I was trying to think of this from the victim's family perspective, and I mean, there's a lot of things that you can be unnerved about, panicked, angry about, frustrated about, you know, with a situation like this. And I think for me, one of them would be the lack of cooperation or interest by both sides of the border as far as the authorities
yeah.
go. One
Definitely.
Side says they just can't do anything. It's not their jurisdiction. You're kind of on your own. The other side does not necessarily seem to be all excited about trying to help. And I almost could see where a father or brother or husband
mm-hmm.
or whatever of a missing abducted person could end up in the hoosegow down there for punching somebody. I mean, the frustration just has to be overwhelming.
The frustration was very overwhelming. I was very frustrated. I had to be held back one time, not physically, but verbally, because I was just like, I couldn't take it. And so we would all kind of snap at different times, and we had to help each other, and it was very hard. We actually got a Mexican police officer, this person who we were turned on to by somebody else, helped us in his off hours. But he never wanted to be found out, because that would have been the end of his job, and then the other police that were on the take wouldn't want that either. But that was a big help towards the end. We had him. I mean, we were very fortunate, and different things just kind of fell together towards the end, and we were very lucky.
Now, Karen, you've probably run across in your research at least other situations where maybe the abducted person didn't have the family support that your person did, mm-hmm. Maybe the financial resources or whatever.
Right.
And what chance do they have? I mean, if the authorities aren't too excited about doing anything, and if the family can't, for whatever reason, lack of interest themselves or lack of finances.
They wait too long. What happens, too, is if somebody has, young adults that want to go off with their friends for a few days, maybe they don't call home, the parents kind of say might become a little bit complacent if they don't hear from somebody for a couple of days. So that adds to it, in some cases, not all. But I was asked that about somebody. He goes, what if this happened to my daughter? I wouldn't have the resources or the know-how to find her. Well, then I'd say, you know what, don't go there, first of all, because it's a scary place. Look at the girl, though, that was kidnapped in Aruba, and she was on a school, we don't know really what happened to her, but she was on a class trip. So sometimes it's just a situation, a coincidence or what have you. But it was very tough not getting help from authorities. That was just, horrendous to have to take it into your own hands in a foreign country. And it was like a third world country, Tijuana.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Oh,
it really is.
Do you have any advice for someone who finds themselves, at least as the family member of an abducted person? Do you have any advice you would give those people, or if they think there's been, they haven't heard from their relative, their loved one for 2 or 3 days, should they wait that long before they start trying to do something, or is it, what do you think?
Follow your gut. Like sometimes your gut will say, it doesn't happen here. There's something wrong. We know there's something wrong. Follow that feeling, because there very well could be. Now, if you think the person's in another country, you've got to act right away. I mean, you just really have to. And use whatever resources you can. Ask for help, not to be afraid to ask for anybody for help. The authorities. Look it up online, what have people done. Do anything that you can, absolutely anything that you can, because time is not your friend in a situation where somebody's missing.
Now, you mentioned that you didn't want to think the worst, but sometimes at night, those thoughts crept into your mind.
Right.
After or at any point during, I'm assuming now, and I know what happens when you assume, but the time dragged on or passed, did those thoughts become more prevalent? I mean, did it get worse or better or stay about the same as far as that aspect of it?
You mean during the 11 days?
Yeah.
Okay, well, they're continually getting worse because the longer it went without knowing anything, the less that you felt you would find anything. But what happened for us was we made posters with our picture in Spanish, and we were putting them up all over Tijuana, and they were showing them to people. And one day, somebody said, I know who that is, gave an incorrect name, but it was close.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what started the chain of events that eventually led to her rescue. But the next day, we heard that the next day they were going to be shipping her to Mexico City. So it was the grace of God and tons of prayers. So many people, I believe, I mean, I prayed all the time. All our family did. Our friends did. So we were very fortunate. We were very, very, very fortunate that it turned out the way that it did. And it doesn't, you know, I mean, other people are probably fortunate too, but some are not.
Yeah, it's certainly a scary, you know, when you've never dealt with it, I suppose, it's kind of tough to, like, because it's not the type of thing you think about, you know, but if you are thrust into that situation, mm-hmm. and suddenly there you are.
Right, then you have to do something.
Yeah, you got to take some action. And, you know, I remember back from the time I was a little kid, you know, I don't want to go back that far. But anyway, the thing was that, you know, if you were ever lost or whatever, you always looked for the guy in uniform, you know, the cop.
Right,
and,
The
cop would help you out.
I would still do that in the United States, for sure.
Yeah.
I would do that in the United States. It's just that in Mexico, you're taking I hate even saying it out loud, but it's the truth, is that some of the police work for the cartel. So
yeah, so the guy wearing the uniform itself doesn't mean much. It's the person in it.
Right.
And their quality and the type of character they are that make the difference. Yeah, because, I would think, too, you just take a young person going into Tijuana or one of the border
mm-hmm.
towns without knowing, and they might think that the cops there are the same as in the U.S. You know, they might think, hey, there's a cop there. If I see something suspicious or feel I'm in any kind of danger, all I got to do is tell that person, and I'm home free, and maybe that person's setting them up for an abduction. I mean, you know, you don't know, but
you don't know, and that's the scary thing. And I think that's why our government has said, you know, you be cautious about crossing that border, especially the border towns, because the cartel really, really run them, and they practically have free reign because they are ruthless. They're so ruthless that it's just not worth it. It is not worth it.
No, there's got to be, you know, other places to see, either in the States or maybe up north of the border. Canada might be a little better, a little safer shot, I would think, than going to the Mexican border towns. And I guess there's been enough over the last few years, enough publicity about the dangers. I mean, it's like you say, you can read the paper almost every day or listen to the TV news or whatever, and there's almost always something happening.
It's just amazing. It is just amazing. I mean, they do kill each other because of turf wars, but they kill people, to just like citizens, their own citizens that are there. They'll kill to make a point. They'll kill just to prove that they can do it. They'll kill for this. They'll do that. It's lawlessness and ruthlessness.
Karen, we've run out of time. I really want to... So thank you for being on with us tonight. And it's a fascinating book, a fascinating story, and the best
thank
of luck
you,
with it.
Oh, thank you so much. It was wonderful speaking with you both.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, Karen,
so
take
much.
Care now. Maybe we'll have you back in the future. Huh?
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And the title of the book, again, is Kidnapped by the Cartel. Thanks to our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday, February 19th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. And if any of you listeners who are interested in the mob, tomorrow night we're doing We Know a Guy show at 7 p.m. Eastern, and our guest is going to be Jonathan Ullman, Executive Director of the Mob Museum in Las Vegas. And we're going to grade the museum's first year. Their anniversary is the 14th of February. So on the anniversary eve, we're going to have Jonathan on and talk about the Mob Museum. And, Cam, thank you very much, and good night.
Thank you, Denny, and good night to you. God bless.